Chapter 70. Signs. I came suddenly awake early the next morning. I didn't know exactly where I was, only that I wasn't where I should be and that something was wrong. I was hiding. Someone was after me. I was curled up in the corner of a small room. I lay on a blanket and I was wrapped in my cloak. This was an inn. It slowly came back to me. I had rented a room at an inn near Imre's docks. I came to my feet, stretching carefully so as not to aggravate my wound. I'd pushed the dresser against the room's only door and tied the window shut with a length of rope, despite the fact that it was too small for a grown man to fit through. Seeing my precautions in the cool blue light of early morning, I was a little embarrassed. I couldn't remember whether I'd slept on the floor out of fear of assassins or bedbugs. Either way, it was clear I hadn't been thinking too clearly toward the end of the night. I gathered up my travel sack and loot and headed downstairs. I had some planning to do, but before that, I needed breakfast and a bath. Despite my busy night, I'd barely slept past sunrise, so I had easy access to the bathhouse. After cleaning myself up and rewrapping the bandage around my side, I felt mostly human. A plate of eggs, a couple sausages, and some fried potatoes later, I felt I could begin to think rationally about my situation. It's amazing how much easier it is to think productively when your belly is full. I sat in the far corner of the little dockside inn and sipped a mug of fresh-pressed apple cider. I was no longer worried that hired killers were going to leap out and assault me. Still, I was sitting with my back to the wall with a good view of the door. Yesterday had left me shaken, mostly because it had caught me so unprepared. In Tarbian, I'd lived each day expecting people would try to kill me. The civilized atmosphere of the university had lulled me into a false sense of security. I never would have been caught off my guard a year ago. I certainly wouldn't have been surprised by the attack itself. My hard-won instincts from Tarbian were urging me to run, leave this place, leave Ambrose and his vendetta far behind. But that feral part of me cared only for safety. It had no plan. I couldn't leave. I had too much invested here. My studies, my vain hopes for gaining a patron, and my stronger hopes of entry to the archives. My precious few friends. Denna. Sailors and dock workers began to filter into the inn to get the morning meal, and the room slowly filled with the gentle buzz of conversation. I heard a bell ringing dimly in the distance, and it occurred to me that my shift in the medica would be starting in an hour. Arwill would notice if I was absent, and he was not forgiving of such things. I fought down the urge to run back to the university. It was well known that absent students were punished with higher tuitions the following term. To give myself something to do while I was thinking through my situation, I brought out my cloak along with needle and thread. The knife from last night had made a straight cut about 2 handspan across. I began to sew it closed, using tiny stitches so the seam wouldn't be obvious. While my hands were working, my thoughts wandered. Could I confront Ambrose? Threaten him? Not likely. He knew I couldn't successfully bring charges against him. But maybe I could persuade a few of the masters of what had really happened. Kilvin would be outraged at the thought of hired killers using a dowsing compass, and perhaps Arwill. All blue fire, every one of them dead, thrown around like rag dolls and the house falling to pieces around them. I was glad to see the end of the place, I can tell you that. I jabbed my finger with the needle as my eavesdropper's ears picked the conversation out of the common room's general din. A few tables over, 2 men were drinking beer. One was tall and balding, the other was fat with a red beard. "You're such an old woman," the fat one laughed. "You'll listen to any piece of gossip." The tall man shook his head somberly. "I was in the tavern when they came in with the news. They were gathering folk with wagons so they could go get the bodies. The whole wedding party dead as leather. Over 30 folks gutted like pigs, and the place burned down in a blue flame, and that weren't the least oddness from what—" He dropped his voice, and I lost what he was saying among the general noise of the room. I swallowed against the sudden dryness in my throat. I slowly tied off the last stitch on my cloak and set it down. I noticed my bleeding finger and absently put it in my mouth. I took a deep breath. I took a drink. Then I walked over to the table where the two men sat talking. "Did you gentlemen come downriver by any chance?" They looked up, obviously irritated by the interruption. Gentlemen had been a mistake. I should have said fellows, fellas. The bald one nodded. "Did you come by way of Morrow?" I asked, picking a northern town at random.
"No,"
the fat one said.
"We're down from Traben."
"Oh, good," I said, my mind racing for a plausible lie. "I have family up in those parts I was thinking of visiting." My mind went blank as I tried to think of a way to ask them for the details of the story I'd overheard. My palms were sweaty. "Are they getting ready for the harvest festival up that way, or have I already missed it?" I finished lamely.
"Still in the works,"
the bald one said, and pointedly turned his shoulder to me. "I heard there was some problem with a wedding up in those parts." The bald one turned back to look at me.
"Well, I don't know how you'd have heard that, as the news was fresh last night, and we just docked down here 10 minutes ago."
He gave me a hard look.
"I don't know what you're selling, boy, but I ain't buying. Piss off, or I'll thump you."
I went back to my seat, knowing I'd made an irrecoverable mess of things. I sat, keeping my hands flat on the table to keep them from shaking. A group of people brutally killed. Blue fire. Oddness. Chandrian. Less than a day ago, the Chandrian were in Traben. I finished my drink more out of reflex than anything else, then stood and made my way to the bar. I was quickly coming to grips with the reality of the situation. After all these years, I finally had the opportunity to learn something about the Chandrian, and not just a mention of them pressed flat between the pages of a book in the archives. I had the chance to see their work firsthand. This was an opportunity that might never come again. But I needed to get to Traben soon, while things were still fresh in people's memories, before curious or superstitious townfolk destroyed what evidence remained. I didn't know what I hoped to find, but anything I heard about the Chandrian would be more than I knew now. And if I were to have a chance at anything useful, I had to be there as soon as possible. Today. The morning crowd was keeping the innkeeper busy, so I had to lay an iron drab on the bar before she paid me any attention at all. After paying for a private room last night, and breakfast, and bath this morning, the drab represented a good portion of my worldly wealth, so I kept my finger on it.
"What do you have?"
she asked as she came up to me.
"How far is it to Traben?"
I asked.
"Upriver? A couple of days."
I didn't ask how long it was. I need to know how far, I said, stressing the last word.
"No need to get snippy,"
she said, wiping her hands on her grubby apron.
"By river it's 40 miles or so. Could take more than 2 days, depending on if you're on a barge or a billow boat, and what the weather's like."
"How far by road?" I asked.
"Blacken me if I know," she muttered, then called down the bar. "Rudd! How far to Traben by road?"
3 or 4 days,
said a weathered man without looking up from his mug.
"I asked how far," she snapped at him. "Is it longer than the riverway?"
"Damn sight longer. About 25 leagues by road. A hard road, too, uphill."
God's body, who measured things in leagues these days? Depending on where that fellow grew up, a league could be anywhere between 2 to 3.5 miles. My father always claimed that a league wasn't really a unit of measurement at all, just a way for farmers to attach numbers to their rough guesses. Still, it let me know Traben was somewhere between 50 and 80 miles to the north. It was probably best to assume the worst, at least 70 miles. The woman behind the bar turned back to me.
"There you have it. Now, can I get you something?"
"I need a water skin, if you have one, or a bottle of water if you don't, and some food that we'll keep on the road. Hard sausage, cheese, flatbread."
"Apples?"
she asked,
Got some lovely red jennies this morning. Good for the road.
I nodded.
And whatever else you have that's cheap and will travel.
A drab doesn't go far, she said with a glance down at the bar.
I shook out my purse and was surprised to see 4 drabs and a copper halfpenny I hadn't accounted for. I was practically rich. She gathered up my money and headed back to the kitchen. I fought off the momentary pang at being utterly destitute again and ran a quick mental inventory of what I had in my travel sack. She came back with 2 loaves of flatbread, a thick, hard sausage that smelled of garlic, a small cheese sealed in wax, a bottle of water, 6 gorgeous bright red apples, and a small sack of carrots and potatoes. I thanked her kindly and stuffed the lot into my sack. 70 miles. I could make it today if I had a good horse. But good horses cost money. I breathed in the smell of rancid fat as I knocked on Debbie's door. I stood there for a minute, fighting the urge to fidget impatiently. I had no idea if Debbie would be awake at such an early hour, but it was a risk I had to take. Debbie opened the door and smiled when she saw me.
"Well, here's a pleasant surprise."
She opened the door wider.
"Come in, sit down."
I gave her my best smile. "Debbie, I just..." She frowned.
"Come in,"
she said more firmly. "I don't discuss business on the landing." I came in and she closed the door behind me.
"Take a seat, unless you'd rather have a bit of a lie down."
She nodded playfully toward the huge curtained bed in the corner of the room.
"You won't believe the story I heard this morning," she said, laughter hiding in her voice.
Despite the urgency I felt, I forced myself to relax. Debbie was not one to be rushed. If I tried, it would only irritate her.
"What did you hear?"
She sat on her side of the desk and folded her hands.
"Apparently, last night, a pair of ruffians tried to lift a purse off a young student. Much to their dismay, it turns out he's the next Taberlin in training. He called down fire and lightning, blinded one, and gave the other such a mighty blow to the head that he still hasn't woken up."
I sat quietly for a moment as I absorbed the information. An hour ago, this would have been the best news I could have heard. Now it was hardly more than a distraction. Still, despite the urgency of my other errand, I couldn't ignore the chance to gather some information about the crisis closer to home.
"They weren't just trying to rob me," I said.
Debbie laughed.
"I knew it was you. They didn't know anything about him except for that he had red hair, but that was enough for me."
"Did I really blind the one?" I asked. "And the other still unconscious?"
"I honestly don't know," Debbie admitted. "News travels quickly among us unsavory types, but it's mostly gossip."
My mind was spinning quickly along a new plan now.
"Would you care to spread a little gossip of your own?" I asked.
"That depends." She gave a wicked smile.
"Is it terribly exciting?"
"Drop my name," I said. "Let them know exactly who it was. Let them know I'm mad as hell, and I'll kill the next ones that come after me. I'll kill them and whoever hired them, the middlemen, their families, their dogs, the whole lot."
Debbie's delighted expression faded to something closer to distaste.
"That's a little grim, don't you think? I appreciate that you're attached to your purse." She gave me a playful look. "And I have a vested interest there myself, but there's no..."
"They weren't thieves," I said. "They were hired to kill me."
Debbie gave me a skeptical look. I tugged up the corner of my shirt to show my bandage.
"I'm serious. I can show you where one of them cut me before I got away."
Frowning, she stood up and came around the other side of the desk.
"All right, show me."
I hesitated, then decided that I was better off humoring her, as I still had favors to ask. I took off my shirt and lay it on the desk.
"That bandage is filthy," she said, as if it was a personal offense.
"Get rid of it." She walked to a cabinet at the back of the room and came back with a black physicker's kit and a wash basin. She washed her hands, then looked at my side.
"You haven't even had it stitched," she said incredulously.
"I've been rather busy," I said, "with the running like hell and hiding all night."
She ignored me and set about cleaning my side with a cool efficiency that let me know she'd studied in the Medica.
"It's messy, but not deep," she said. "It's not even all the way through the skin in some places."
She stood up and pulled a few things out of her bag.
"You'll still need stitches."
"I would have done it myself," I said,
But you're an idiot who didn't even make sure this was cleaned properly," she finished.
"If this gets infected, it would serve you right."
She finished cleaning my side and rinsed her hands in the bowl.
"I want you to know I'm doing this because I have a soft spot for pretty boys, the mentally infirm, and people who owe me money. I consider this protecting my investment."
"Yes, ma'am." I sucked in air when she applied the antiseptic.
"I thought you weren't supposed to bleed," she said matter-of-factly.
"There's another legend proven false."
Speaking of, moving as little as possible, I reached out and pulled a book out of my travel sack, then laid it on her desk.
"I brought back your copy of Mating Habits of the Common Dracus.
You were right. The engravings added a lot to it."
"I knew you'd like it."
There was a moment of silence as she began stitching me back together. When she spoke again, most of the playfulness was gone from her voice.
"Were these fellows really hired to kill you, Quoth?"
I nodded. "They had a dowsing compass in some of my hair. That's how they knew I was a redhead."
"Lord and lady, wouldn't that just send Kilvin into a froth?" She shook her head.
"Are you sure they weren't just hired to scare you? Rough you up a little to teach you to mind your betters?"
She paused in her stitching and looked up at me.
"You weren't stupid enough to borrow money off of Heffron and his boys, were you?"
I shook my head.
"You're the only hawk for me, Devi," I smiled. "In fact, that's why I stopped by today.
And here I thought you merely enjoyed my company," she said, turning back to her needlework. I thought I detected a tinge of irritation in her voice.
"Let me finish this first." I thought about what she'd said for a long moment. The tall man had said, "Let's do him," but that could mean any number of things.
"It's possible they weren't trying to kill me," I admitted slowly. "He had a knife, though. You don't need a knife to give someone a beating."
Devi snorted.
"And I don't need blood to get people to settle their debts, but it certainly helps."
I thought about it as she tied off the final stitch and began to wrap me in a fresh bandage. Maybe it was meant to be a simple beating. An anonymous message from Ambrose telling me to mind my betters. Maybe it was a simple attempt to scare me off. I sighed, trying not to move too much as I did so.
"I'd like to believe that's the case, but I really don't think so. I think they were really after blood. That's what my gut tells me."
Her expression grew serious.
"In that case, I will spread the word a little," she said. "I don't know about the part about killing their dogs, but I'll drop a few things into the rumor mill so people will think twice about taking that sort of job."
She chuckled low in her throat.
"Actually, they're already thinking twice after last night. This will make them think three times."
"I appreciate it."
"Small trouble to me,"
she said dismissively as she stood up and brushed off her knees.
"A small favor to help a friend."
She washed her hands in the basin, then dried them carelessly on her shirt.
"Let's hear it,"
she said as she sat behind the desk, her expression suddenly businesslike.
"I need money for a fast horse," I said.
"Leaving town?" She arched a pale eyebrow.
"You never struck me as the running away sort."
"I'm not running," I said. "But I need to cover some ground. 70 miles before it gets much afternoon."
Devi widened her eyes a bit.
"A horse that could make that trip is going to cost," she said. "Why not just buy a post note and switch out fresh horses all the way? Faster and cheaper."
"There's no post stations where I'm going," I said. "Up river, then into the hills. A little town called Traben."
"All right," she said. "How much are you looking for?"
"I'll need money to buy a fast horse with no dickering, plus lodging, food, maybe bribes. 20 talents.
She burst out laughing, then regained her composure and covered her mouth.
No. I'm sorry, but no.
I do have a soft spot for charming young men like yourself, but it's not on my head.
I have my loot, I said, sliding the case forward with my foot,
for collateral, plus anything else in here.
I put my travel sack on the desk.
She drew a breath as if to refuse me out of hand, then shrugged and looked into the bag, poking around. She pulled out my copy of Rhetoric and Logic, and a moment later, my handheld sympathy lamp.
Hello, she said curiously, thumbing on the switch and pointing the light toward the wall. This is interesting.
I grimaced.
Anything except that, I said.
I promised Kilvin I wouldn't ever let that out of my hands. I gave my word.
She gave me a frank look.
Have you ever heard the expression, beggars can't be choosers?
I gave my word, I repeated. I unpinned my silver talent pipes from my cloak and slid them across her desk so they lay near Rhetoric and Logic.
Those aren't easy to come by, you know.
Devi looked at the lute, the book, and the pipes, and drew a long, slow breath.
Quoth, I can tell that this is important to you, but the numbers just don't add. You're not good for that much money. You're barely good for the four talents you owe me.
That stung. Mostly because I knew it to be the truth.
Devi thought about it for another second, then shook her head firmly.
No, just the interest. In 2 months, you'd owe me over 35 talents.
Or something equally valuable in trade, I said.
She gave me a gentle smile.
And what do you have worth 35 talents?
Access to the archives.
Devi sat, her slightly patronizing smile frozen on her face.
You're lying.
I shook my head.
I know there's another way in. I haven't found it yet, but I will.
That's a lot of if.
Devi's tone was skeptical, but her eyes were full of something more than simple desire. It was closer to hunger, or lust. I could tell she wanted into the archives just as badly as I did. Perhaps even more so.
That's what I'm offering, I said. If I can pay you back, I will. If not, when I find a way into the archives, I'll share it with you.
Devi looked up at the ceiling as if calculating odds in her head.
With these things as collateral, and the possibility of access to the archives, I can loan you a dozen talents.
I stood up and swung my travel sack over my shoulder.
I'm afraid we're not bargaining here, I said. I'm just informing you as to the conditions of the loan.
I gave her an apologetic smile.
It's 20 talents or nothing.
I'm sorry, I didn't make that clear from the beginning.
Chapter 71. Strange Attraction. 3 minutes later, I strode toward the doors of the nearest livery. A well-dressed Sealdish man smiled at my approach and stepped forward to greet me.
"Ah, young sir," he said, holding out his hand. "My name is Kerva. Might I ask—"
"I need a horse," I said, shaking his hand quickly. "Healthy, well-rested, and well-fed. One that can take 6 hours of hard riding today."
"Certainly, certainly,"
Kerva said, rubbing his hands together and nodding.
"All things are possible with the will of God. I'd be pleased to—"
"Listen," I interrupted again. "I'm in a hurry. So we're going to skip the preliminaries. I won't pretend to be uninterested. You won't waste my time with a parade of hacks and nags. If I have not bought a horse in 10 minutes, I will leave and buy one elsewhere." I met his eye. "Linsatva?" The Sealdish man was aghast.
"Sir, the purchase of a horse should never be so rushed. You would not pick a wife in 10 minutes, and on the road, a horse is more important than a wife."
He gave a bashful smile.
"Even God himself didn't—"
I cut him off yet again. "God's not buying a horse today. I am." The thin Sealdish man paused to collect his thoughts.
"Right,"
he said softly, more to himself than to me. "Hlin, come around and see what we have."
He led me around the outside of the stables to a small corral. He gestured near the edge of the fence.
"That dapple mare is as steady a horse as any you could hope for. She'll take you..."
I ignored him and looked over the half-dozen hacks that stood idly inside the fence. Though I had neither means nor reason to keep a horse, I knew good from bad, and nothing I saw here came close to suiting my needs. You see, troopers live and die by the horses that pull their wagons, and my parents had not neglected my education in this area. I could size up a horse by the time I was 8, and a good thing, too. Townsfolk regularly tried to pass off half-dead or gingered-up nags to us, knowing that by the time we discovered our mistakes, we'd be miles and days away. There was a world of trouble waiting for a man who sold his neighbor some sickly hobble, but what was the harm of swindling one of the filthy, thieving roue? I turned to face the cavalier, frowning. "You have just wasted 2 precious minutes of my time, so I'm guessing you still don't understand my position here. Let me be as plain as possible. I want a fast horse, ready for hard riding today. For this I will pay quickly, in hard coin, and without complaint." I held up my newly heavy purse in one hand and shook it, knowing he could tell the ring of true sealedish silver inside. "If you sell me a horse that throws a shoe, or starts to limp, or spooks at shadows, I will miss a valuable opportunity, a quite unrecoverable opportunity. If that happens, I will not come back and demand a refund. I will not petition the constable. I will walk back to Imray this very night and set fire to your house. Then, when you run out the front door in your nightshirt and stockle cap, I will kill you, cook you, and eat you, right there on your lawn while all your neighbors watch." I gave him a deadly serious look. "This is the business arrangement I am proposing, Kerva. If you are not comfortable with it, tell me and I will go elsewhere. Otherwise, leave off this parade of drays and show me a real horse." The short sealed looked at me, more stunned than horrified. I could see him trying to come to grips with the situation. He must think I was either a raving lunatic, or the son of some important noble, or both.
"Very well," he said,
letting all the ingratiating charm fall from his voice.
"When you say hard riding, how hard do you mean?"
"Very hard," I said. "I need to go 70 miles today, dirt roads."
"Will you need saddle and tack, too?"
I nodded. "Nothing fancy, nothing new." He drew a deep breath.
"Fine. And how much do you have to spend?"
I shook my head and gave a tight smile.
"Show me the horse and name your price.
Evalder would do nicely. If he's a little wild, I won't mind if it means he's got energy to spare. Even a good Valder mix could serve me, or a Kershaan fourth horse." Kerva nodded and led me back toward the wide doors of the stable.
"I do have a Kershaan. A full blood, actually."
He made a gesture to one of the stable hands.
"Bring out our black gentleman. Double quick."
The boy sprinted off. The cavalier turned back to me.
"Gorgeous animal. I ran him through the traces before I bought him, just to be sure. Galloped him a full mile, and he hardly even worked up his sweat. Smooth a gait as ever I felt, and I'd not lie to your lordship on that account."
I nodded. A full-blooded Kershaan was exactly suited to my purpose. They had a legendary endurance, but there would be no avoiding the price either. A well-trained fourth horse was worth a dozen talents.
"How much are you asking for him?"
"I'll want 2 solid marks,"
he said, without any hint of apology or wheedling in his voice. Merciful Talu, 20 talents! He'd have to have silver shoes to be worth that much.
"I'm in no mood for a lengthy dicker, Kerva," I said shortly. "You've made me well aware of that, milord," he said. "I'm telling you my honest price. Here, you'll see why."
The boy hurried out, leading a sleek monster of a horse, at least 18 hands tall, proud head, and black from his nose to the tip of his tail.
"He loves to run,"
Kerva said with genuine affection in his voice. He ran a hand along the smooth black neck.
"And look at that color! Not so much as a pale whisker. That's why he's worth 20 if he's worth a single shim."
"I don't care about the color," I said absent-mindedly, while I looked him over for signs of injury or old age. There was nothing.
He was glossy, young, strong. I just need to move quickly.
I understand, he said apologetically. But I can't just ignore the coloring. If I wait a span or two, some young lord will pay just for the snappy look of him.
I knew it was true. Does he have a name? I asked, moving slowly toward the black horse, letting him smell my hands and get used to me. Bargaining can be hurried, but befriending a horse cannot. Only a fool rushes first impressions with a spirited young Kershaean.
Not one that's stuck on him, he said.
What's your name, boy? I asked gently, just so he could get used to the sound of my voice. He snuffled delicately at my hand, keeping close watch with one large, intelligent eye. He didn't back away, but he certainly wasn't at his ease either. I kept talking as I came closer, hoping he would relax at the sound of my voice. You deserve a good name. I hate to see some lordling with delusions of wit saddle you with some terrible name like Midnight or Sooty or Scut. I came closer and lay one hand along his neck. His skin twitched, but he didn't pull away. I needed to be sure of his temperament as much as his stamina. I couldn't take the risk of jumping on the back of a skittish horse. Someone half clever might dub you Pitch or Scuttle, ill-favored names, or Slate, a sedentary name. Heaven forbid you end up Blackie. That's an ill-fitting name for a prince like you. My father always talked to new horses in this way, in a steady, calming litany. As I stroked his neck, I kept speaking without giving any mind to what I said. Words don't matter to the horse. The tone of your voice is the important thing. You've come a long way. You should have a proud name, so folk won't think of you as common. Was your previous owner Sealdish? I asked.
Vivaniloi. Deuterium Cata? Palante?
I could sense him relax a bit at the sound of the familiar language. I walked onto his other side, still looking him over carefully and letting him get used to my presence.
Dugetha?
I asked him. Are you Cole?
Dumane?
Are you a shadow? I wanted to say twilight, but I couldn't bring the Siaru word to mind. Rather than pause, I just bulled ahead, faking it as best I could as I eyed his hooves to see if they were chipped or cracked.
Duketh Salen?
Are you first knight? The big black lowered his head and nuzzled me.
You like that one, do you?
I said with a bit of a laugh, knowing that what really happened was that he had caught scent of the package of dried apple I had tucked in one of the pockets of my cloak. The important thing was that he had a feel for me now. If he was comfortable enough to nuzzle at me for food, we could get along well enough for a hard day's ride. Keth Salen seems to suit him for a name, I said, turning back to Kierva. Anything else I need to know? Kierva seemed disconcerted.
He shies a bit on his right side.
A bit?
Just a bit. It stands to reason that he's probably a bit prone to spooking on that side, too, but I haven't seen him do it.
How's he trained? Close rein or trooper style?
Close.
Fine. You've got 1 minute left to make this deal. He's a good animal, but I'm not paying 20 talents for him. I spoke with certainty in my voice, but no hope in my heart. He was a gorgeous animal, and his coloring made him worth at least 20 talents. Still, I'd go through the motions and hope to squeeze the man down to 19. That at least would leave me money for food and lodging when I got to Traban.
Very well,
Kierva said.
16.
Only my years of stage training kept me from gaping openly at his sudden drop.
15,
I said, feigning irritation. And that will include the saddle, tack, and a bag of oats. I began pulling money out of my purse as if the deal was already finished. Unbelievably, Kierva nodded and called for one of the boys to bring a saddle and tack. I counted the money into Kerva's hand as his assistant saddled the big black. The Sealed seemed uncomfortable meeting my eye. If I didn't know horses as well as I do, I would have thought I was being swindled. Maybe the horse was stolen, or the man was desperate for money. Whatever the reason, I didn't care. I was due a bit of good luck, Best of all, this meant that I might be able to resell the horse at a bit of a profit after I reached Traben. Honestly, I would need to sell him as soon as I could manage, even if I lost money on the deal. Stabling, food, and grooming for a horse like this would cost me a penny a day. I couldn't afford to keep him. I strapped my travel sack into a saddlebag, checked the cinch and stirrups, then swung myself up onto Kethsalen's back. He danced slightly to the right, eager to be off. That made two of us. I twitched the reins, and we were on our way. Most problems with horses have nothing to do with the horses themselves. They stem from the ignorance of the rider. Folk shoe their horses badly, saddle them improperly, feed them poorly, then complain that they were sold a half-lame, swayback, ill-tempered hack. I knew horses. My parents had taught me to ride and care for them, while most of my experience had been with sturdier breeds, bred to pull rather than to race. I knew how to cover ground quickly when I needed to. When they're in a hurry, most folk push their mount too hard too soon. They head out at a dead gallop, then find themselves with a horse lame or half-dead inside an hour. Pure idiocy. Only a 12-color bastard treats a horse that way. But to be entirely truthful, I would have ridden Kethsalen to death if it would have brought me to Traben in a timely fashion. There are some times when I'm willing to be a bastard. I would have killed a dozen horses if it would have helped me get more information about the Chandrian and why they had killed my parents. But ultimately, there was no sense in thinking that way. A dead horse wouldn't get me to Traben. A live one would. So I started Kethsalen at a nice walk to warm him up. He was eager to go faster, probably sensing my own impatience, and that would have been fine if I'd only needed to go a mile or three. But I needed him for at least 50, maybe 70, and that meant patience. I had to rein him back down to a walk twice before he resigned himself to it. After a mile, I trotted him for a bit. His gait was smooth, even for a Kershane, but a trot is jarring no matter what, and it pulled at the new stitches in my side. I urged him up to a canter after another mile or so. Only after we were 3 or 4 miles out of Imre and we came to a good straight stretch of flat road did I nudge him up to a gallop. Finally, given the chance to run, he surged ahead. The sun had just finished burning away the morning dew, and farmers harvesting wheat and barley in the fields looked up as we thundered past. Kethsalen was fast, so fast that the wind tore at my cloak, stretching it behind me like a flag. Despite the fact that I knew I must cut quite the dramatic figure, I quickly grew tired of the drag on my neck, unfastened the cloak, then stuffed it into a saddlebag. When we passed through a stand of trees, I brought Salen back down to a trot. That way he got a little rest, and we didn't run the risk of rounding a corner and barreling into a fallen tree or slow-moving cart. When we came out into pasture land, I could see our way was clear. I gave him his head again, and we practically flew. After an hour and a half of this, Salen was sweating and breathing hard, but he was doing better than I was. My legs were a rubbery mess. I was fit enough and young, but I hadn't been in the saddle for years. Riding uses different muscles than walking, and riding at a gallop is just as hard as running unless you want to make your horse work twice as hard for every mile. Suffice to say, I welcomed the next stretch of trees. I hopped out of the saddle and walked to give both of us a well-deserved break. I cut one of my apples down the middle and gave him the larger half. I figured we'd come about 30 miles, and the sun wasn't even fully at zenith. "That's the easy bit," I told him, stroking his neck fondly. "Lord, but you are lovely. You're not half blown yet, are you?" We walked for about 10 minutes. Then we had the good luck to come across a little creek with a wooden bridge running across it. I let him drink for a long minute, then pulled him away before he took too much. Then I mounted up and gated him back up to a gallop by slow stages. My legs burned and ached as I leaned over his neck. The drumming of his hooves was like a counterpoint to the slow song of the wind endlessly burning past my ears. The first snag came about an hour later, when we had to cross a wide stream. It wasn't treacherous by any means, but I had to unsaddle him and carry everything across rather than risk it getting wet. I couldn't ride him for hours wearing a wet harness. On the other side of the river, I dried him off with my blanket and resaddled him. It took half an hour, which meant he had gone from being rested to being cold, so I had to warm him up gently, slow walk to trot, to canter. That stream cost me an hour, all told. I worried if there was another one, the chill would get into Salen's muscles. If that happened, Talu himself wouldn't be able to bring him up to a gallop again. An hour later, I passed through a small town, hardly more than a church and a tavern that happened to be next to each other. I stopped long enough to let Salen drink a bit from a trough. I stretched my numb legs and looked up anxiously at the sun. After that, the fields and farms grew fewer and farther between. The trees grew thicker and denser. The road narrowed and was not in good repair, rocky in places, washed out in others. It made for slower and slower going, but truth be told, neither myself nor Kefsalen had much more galloping left in us. Eventually, we came to another stream crossing the road, not much more than a foot deep at the most. The water had a hard, sharp, foul smell that let me know there was a tannery upstream, or a refinery. There wasn't any bridge, and Kefsalen made his way slowly across, placing his hooves gingerly on the rocky bottom. I wondered idly if it felt good, like when you dandle your feet in the water after a long day's walking. The stream didn't slow us down much, but over the next half hour, we had to cross it three separate times as it wound back and forth across the road. It was an inconvenience more than anything, never much deeper than a foot and a half. Each time we crossed it, the acrid smell of the water was worse, solvents and acids. If not a refinery, then at least a mine. I kept my hands on the reins, ready to pull Salen's head up if he tried to drink, but he was smarter than that. A long canter later, I came up over a hill and looked down onto a crossroads at the bottom of a small, grassy valley. Right under the signpost was a tinker with a pair of donkeys, one of them loaded so high with bags and bundles that it looked ready to tip over, the other conspicuously unburdened. It stood by the side of the dirt road, grazing, with a small mountain of gear piled beside it. The tinker sat on a small stool at the side of the road, looking dispirited. His expression brightened when he saw me riding down the hill. I read the signpost as I came closer. North was Traben. South was Tem Falls. I reined in as I approached. Kefsalen and I could both use the rest, and I was not in enough of a hurry to be rude to a tinker. Not by half. If nothing else, the fellow could tell me how far I had left to go before I came to Traben.
"Hello there,"
he said, looking up at me, shading his eyes with one hand.
"You've got the look of a lad that's wanting something."
He was older, balding, with a round, friendly face. I laughed. "I'm wanting a lot of things, Tinker, but I don't think you've got any of them in your packs." He gave me an ingratiating smile.
"Well, now, don't go assuming."
He stopped and looked down for a moment, thoughtfully. When he met my eyes again, his expression was still kind, but more serious than before.
"Listen, I'll be honest with you, son. My little donkey has got herself a stone bruise in her forehoof and can't carry her load. I'm stuck here until I come by some manner of help."
"Normally nothing would make me happier than to help you, Tinker," I said. "But I need to get to Traben as quickly as I can."
"That won't take much doing,"
he nodded over the hill to the north.
"You're only about a half mile out. If the wind was blowing southerly, you could smell the smoke."
I looked in the direction he gestured and saw chimney smoke rising from behind the hill. A great wave of relief washed over me. I'd made it, and it was barely an hour after noon. The tinker continued.
"I need to get to the Easedown docks,"
he nodded to the east.
"I've made arrangements to ship down river, and I'd dearly love to catch my boat."
He eyed my horse significantly.
"But I'll need a new pack animal to carry my gear."
It seems my luck had finally turned. Salen was a fine horse, but now that I was in Traben, he would be little more than a constant drain on my limited resources. Still, it's never wise to look eager to sell. "This is an awful lot of horse to be used for packing," I said, patting Kefsalen's neck. "He's a full-blooded Kershain, and I can tell you I've never seen a better horse in all my days." The tinker looked him over skeptically.
"He's knackered is what he is," he said. "He hasn't got another mile left in him."
I swung off the saddle, staggering a bit when my rubbery legs almost buckled underneath me. "You should give him more credit, Tinker. He's come all the way from Imre today." The Tinker chuckled.
"You're not a bad liar, boy, but you need to know when to stop. If the bait's too big, the fish won't bite."
I didn't need to pretend to be horrified. "I'm sorry I didn't properly introduce myself." I held out my hand. "My name is Quoth. I'm a trooper and one of the Edema Rue. Never on my most desperate day would I lie to a tinker." The tinker shook my hand.
"Well," he said, slightly taken aback, "my sincere apologies to you and your family. It's rare to see one of your folk alone on the road."
He looked the horse over critically.
"All the way from Imre, you say?"
I nodded.
"That's what, almost 60 miles? Hell of a ride."
He looked at me with a knowing smile.
"How are your legs?"
I grinned back at him. "Let's just say I'll be glad to be on my own feet again. He's good for another 10 miles, I'd guess, but I can't say the same for myself." The tinker looked over the horse again and gave a gusty sigh.
"Well, as I said, you've got me over a bit of a barrel. How much do you want for him?"
"Well," I said, "Keth Salen here is a full-blooded Kershane, and his color is lovely, you have to admit. Not a patch on him but isn't black. Not a white whisker." The tinker burst out laughing.
"I take it back," he said. "You're a terrible liar."
"I don't see what's so funny," I said a little stiffly. The tinker gave me an odd look.
"Not a white whisker, no?"
He nodded past me towards Salen's hindquarters.
"But if he's all black, then I'm Orin Velsiter."
I turned to look and saw that Keth Salen's left hind foot had a distinct white sock that went halfway up to his hock. Stupefied, I walked back and bent down to look. It wasn't a clean white, more of a washed-out gray. I could smell the faint odor of the stream we had splashed through on the last leg of our journey. Solvents. "That shim bastard," I said incredulously. "He sold me a dyed horse."
"Didn't the name tip you off?"
the tinker chuckled.
"Keth Salen? Lord, boy, someone's been thumbing their nose at you."
"His name means twilight," I said. The tinker shook his head.
"Your Siaru is rusty. Ket Salem would be first night. Salen means sock. His name is One Sock."
I thought back to the horse trader's reaction when I'd picked the name. No wonder the fellow had seemed so disconcerted. No wonder he had dropped the price so quickly and easily. He thought I knew his little secret. The tinker laughed at my expression and clapped me on the back.
"Don't sweat it, lad. It happens to the best of us from time to time."
He turned away and began to rummage through his bundles.
"I think I have something you'll like. Let me offer you a trade."
He turned around and held out something black and gnarled like a piece of driftwood. I took it from him and looked it over. It was heavy and cold to the touch. "A lump of slag iron?" I asked. "Are you out of magic beans?" The tinker held out a pin in his other hand. He held it about a handspan away, then let go. Instead of falling, the pin snapped to the side and clung to the smooth blob of black iron. I drew in an appreciative breath. A lodestone? I've never seen one of these.
"Technically, it's a Traben stone," he said matter-of-factly, "as it's never been near Loden, but you're near enough. There's all manner of people who would be interested in that beauty down Imre way."
I nodded absently as I turned it over in my hands. I'd always wanted to see a drawstone, ever since I was a child. I pulled the pin away, feeling the strange attraction it had to smooth black metal. I marveled. A piece of star iron in my hand. "How much do you figure it's worth?" I asked. The tinker sucked his teeth a little.
"Well, I'm figuring right here and now it's worth just about one full-blooded Kershane pack mule."
I turned it over in my hand, pulled the pin away, and let it snap back again. Trouble is, Tinker, I put myself into debt with a dangerous woman in order to buy this horse. If I don't sell it well, I'm going to be in a desperate way. He nodded.
Piece of sky iron of that size? If you take less than 18 talents, you're cutting a hole in your own purse. Jewelers will buy it, or rich folk who want it for the novelty.
He tapped the side of his nose.
But if you head to the university, you'll do better. Artificers have a great love for lodestone. Alchemists, too. If you find one in the right mood, you'll get more.
It was a good deal. Manette had taught me lodestone was quite valuable and difficult to come by, not only for its galvanic properties, but because pieces of sky iron like this often had rare metals mingled with the iron. I held out my hand. I'm willing to make it a deal. We shook hands solemnly. Then, just as the tinker began to reach for the reins, I asked, "And what will you give me for his tack and saddle?" I was a little worried that the tinker might take offense at my wheedling, but instead he smiled a sly smile.
"That's a clever lad," he chuckled. "I like a fellow who's not afraid to push for a little extra. What would you like, then? I've got a lovely woolen blanket here, or some nice rope."
He pulled a coil of it out of the donkey's packs.
"Always good to have a piece of rope with you. Ooh, how about this?"
He turned around with a bottle in his hands and winked at me.
"I've got some lovely Avenish fruit wine. I'll give you all three for your horse's gear."
I could use a spare blanket, I admitted. Then a thought occurred to me. "Do you have any clothes near my size? I seem to be going through a lot of shirts lately." The old man paused, holding the rope and bottle of wine, then shrugged and began to dig around in his packs. "Have you heard anything about a wedding around these parts?" I asked. Tinkers always have their ears to the ground.
"The Mothin wedding?"
He tied off one pack and began to dig through another.
"I hate to tell you, but you missed it. Happened yesterday."
My stomach clenched at his casual tone. If there had been a massacre, the tinker would certainly have heard. I suddenly had the horrible thought that I'd put myself in debt and run halfway to the mountains on a goose chase. "Were you there? Did anything odd happen?"
"Here we are."
The tinker turned around, holding up a shirt of plain gray homespun.
"Nothing fancy, I'm afraid, but it's new. Well, newish."
He held it up to my chest to judge the fit. "The wedding?" I prompted.
"What? Oh, no, I wasn't there. Bit of an event, though, from what I understand. Mothin's only daughter, and they were sending her off proper. Been planning it for months."
"So you didn't hear of anything odd happening?" I asked, a sinking feeling in my gut. He shrugged helplessly.
"Like I said, I wasn't there. I've been up around the ironworks the last couple days."
He nodded to the west.
"Trading with panners and folk up in the high rock."
He tapped the side of his head as if he just remembered something.
"That reminds me. I found a brassy up in the hills."
He rummaged in his packs again and brought out a flat, thick bottle.
"If you don't care for wine, maybe something a little stronger."
I started to shake my head, then realized that some homemade brand would be useful cleaning my side tonight. "I might be," I said, "depending on the offer on the table."
"Honest young gent like yourself," he said grandly, "I'll give you blanket, both bottles, and the coil of rope."
"You're generous, Tinker, but I'd rather have the shirt than the rope and the fruit wine. They'd just be dead weight in my bag, and I've got a lot of walking ahead of me." His expression soured a little, but he shrugged.
"Your call, of course. Blanket, shirt, brand, and three jots."
We shook hands, and I took time to help him load Keth Salen because I had a vague feeling that I'd insulted him by turning down his previous offer. 10 minutes later, he was heading east, and I made my way north over the green hills into Traben. I was glad to walk the last half mile under my own power, as it helped me work the stiffness from my legs and back. As I crested the hill, I saw Traben sprawling out below, tucked into a low bowl made by the hills. It wasn't a large town by any means, perhaps 100 buildings sprawling around a dozen winding packed dirt streets.
In the early days with the troop, I'd learned how to size up a town. It's a lot like reading your audience when you're playing in a tavern. The stakes are higher, of course. Play the wrong song in a tavern, and people might hiss you, but misjudge an entire town, and things can get uglier than that. So I sized up Traben. It was off the beaten path, halfway between a mining town and a farming town. They weren't likely to be instantly suspicious of strangers, but it was small enough that everyone knew by looking at you that you weren't one of the locals. I was surprised to see people setting up straw-stuffed shamblemen outside their homes. That meant that despite the proximity to Imre and the university, Traben was truly a backwater community. Every town has a harvest festival of some sort, but these days, most folks settle for having a bonfire and getting drunk. The fact that they were following old folk traditions meant people in Traben were more superstitious than I would usually expect. Despite that, I liked seeing the shamblemen. I have a fondness for the traditional harvest festivals, superstitions and all. They're a type of theater, really. The Tailing Church was the nicest building in town, 3 stories tall and made of quarried stone. Nothing odd about that, but bolted above the front doors, high above the ground, was one of the biggest iron wheels I'd ever seen. It was real iron, too, not just painted wood. It was 10 feet tall and must have weighed a solid ton. Ordinarily, such a display would have made me nervous. But since Traben was a mining town, I guessed it showed civic pride more than fanatic piety. Most of the other buildings in town were low to the ground, built of rough timber with cedar shingle roofs. The inn was respectable, though, 2 stories tall, with plaster walls and red clay tiles on the roof. There was bound to be someone in there who would know more about the wedding. There was a bare handful of people inside. Not surprising, as harvest was in full swing, and there were still 5 or 6 hours of good daylight left. I put on my best anxious expression as I made my way over to the bar where the innkeeper stood. "Excuse me," I said. "I hate to trouble you, but I'm looking for someone." The innkeeper was a dark-haired man with a perpetual scowl.
"Who's that, then?"
"My cousin was here for a wedding," I said, "and I heard there was some trouble." At the word wedding, the innkeeper's scowl turned stony. I could feel the 2 men farther down the bar not looking at me, pointedly not looking anywhere in my direction. It was true, then. Something terrible had happened. I saw the innkeeper reach out and press his fingers onto the bar. It took me a second to realize he was touching the iron head of a nail driven into the wood.
"Bad business," he said shortly. "Nothing I care to say about it."
"Please," I said, letting worry bleed into my tone. "I was visiting family in Thames Falls when the rumor came down that something had happened. They're all busy pulling in the last of the wheat, so I promised I'd come up and see what the trouble was." The innkeeper looked me up and down. A gawker, he could turn away. But he couldn't deny me the right to know what had happened to a family member.
"There's the one upstairs who was there," he said shortly. "Not from around here. Might be your cousin."
A witness. I opened my mouth to ask another question, but he shook his head.
"I don't know a thing about it," he said firmly. "Don't care to either."
He turned and made himself suddenly busy with the taps of his beer barrels.
"Up at the far end of the hall, on the left."
I headed across the room and up the stairs. I could feel everyone not looking at me now. Their silence and the innkeeper's tone made it clear that whoever was upstairs was not one of the many who had been there. It was the one. One survivor. I went to the end of the hallway and knocked on the door. First softly, then again, louder. I opened the door slowly so as not to startle whoever might be inside. It was a narrow room with a narrow bed. A woman lay on it, fully clothed, one arm wrapped in a bandage. Her head was turned toward the window so I could only see her profile. Still, I recognized her. Denna. I must have made some noise because she turned to look at me. Her eyes went wide, and for once she was the one who was at a loss for words. "I heard you were in some trouble," I said nonchalantly, "so I thought I'd come and help." Her eyes went wide for a moment, then narrowed. "You're lying.
she said with a wry twist to her lips. "I am," I admitted. "But it's a pretty lie." I took a step into the room and closed the door softly. "I would have come if I'd known." "Anyone can make the trip after they get the news," she said dismissively. "It takes a special sort of man to show up when he doesn't know there's trouble." She sat up and turned to face me, swinging her legs over the side of the bed. Now that I looked more closely, I noticed that she had a bruise high on one temple in addition to the bandage on her arm. I took another step toward her. "Are you all right?" I asked. "No," she said bluntly, "but I could be a damn sight worse off." She came to her feet slowly, as if she was unsure how steady she would be. She took a cautious step or two and seemed more or less satisfied. "Right. I can walk. Let's get out of here."
Chapter 72. Borrow-Rill. Denna turned left instead of right as she came out of her room. At first, I thought she was disoriented, but when she came to a back stairway, I saw she was actually trying to leave without heading through the tap room. She found the alley door, but it was locked fast. So we headed out the front. As soon as we entered the tap room, I was pointedly aware of everyone's attention on us. Denna made a beeline for the front door, moving but with slow determination of a storm cloud. We were almost out when the man behind the bar called out, "Oi! Hey now!" Denna's eyes flickered to the side. Her mouth made a thin line, and she continued her walk to the door as if she hadn't heard. "I'll deal with him," I said softly. "Wait for me. I'll be out in just a second." I walked over to where the barman stood scowling.
"That your cousin, then?" he asked. "Has the constable said she can go?"
"I thought you didn't want to know anything about it," I said.
"I surely don't. But she's had use of the room and meals, and I had the doctor out to patch her up."
I gave him a hard look. If there's a doctor in this town worth more than a half penny, then I'm the king of Vint.
"I'm out half a talent and all," he insisted. "Bandages ain't free, and I had a woman by to sit with her, waiting for her to wake up."
I doubted very much that he was out half that, but I certainly didn't want trouble with the constable. In truth, I didn't want any sort of delay. Given Denna's tendencies, I was worried that if I lost sight of her for more than a minute, she would disappear like morning fog. I took 5 jots from my purse and scattered them onto the bar. "Knackers profit from a plague," I said scathingly, and left. I felt a ridiculous amount of relief when I saw Denna waiting outside, leaning against the horse post. Her eyes were closed, and she had her face tilted toward the sun. She sighed contentedly and turned toward the sound of my approaching footsteps. "Was it that bad?" I asked. "They were kind enough at first," Denna admitted, gesturing with her bandaged arm. "But this old woman kept checking in on me." She frowned and brushed her long black hair back, giving me a clear view of the purpling bruise that spread from her temple all the way back to her hairline. "You know the type. Some tight-laced spinster with a mouth like a cat's ass." I burst out laughing, and Denna's sudden smile was like the sun peering from behind a cloud. Then her face grew dark again as she continued. "She kept giving me this look, like I should have had the decency to die with all the other folk. Like all this was my fault." Denna shook her head. "But she was better than the old men. The constable put his hand on my leg." She shuddered. "Even the mayor came, clucking over me like he cared, but he was only there to badger me with questions. What were you doing there? What happened? What did you see?" The scorn in Denna's voice made me bite back my own questions so quickly that I almost caught my tongue between my teeth. It's my nature to ask questions. Not to mention that the whole purpose of this mad dash into the foothills was to investigate what had happened. Still, the tone of Denna's voice made it clear she was in no mood to give answers right now. I shrugged my travel sack higher up onto my shoulder, and something occurred to me. "Wait! Your things! You left them all back in your room." Denna hesitated for a heartbeat. "I don't think anything of mine was there," she said, as if the thought hadn't even occurred to her before. "Are you sure you don't want to go back and check?" She shook her head firmly. "I leave where I'm not welcome,"
she said matter-of-factly. Everything else I can make up along the way. Denna started to walk down the street, and I fell in beside her. She turned onto a narrow side street, heading west. We passed an old woman hanging a shamble man made of oat sheaves. It wore a crude straw hat and a pair of sackcloth pants. "Where are we headed?" I asked. "I need to see if my things are out at the Moffin Farm," she said. "After that, I'm open to suggestions." "Where were you planning to go before you found me?"
"Honestly, I was heading out to the Moffin Farm myself."
Denna gave me a sideways look.
"Fair enough. It's only about a mile out to the farm. We can be there and still have plenty of light."
The land around Traben was rough, mostly thick forest broken by stretches of rocky ground. Then the road would round a corner, and there would be a small, perfect field of golden wheat tucked among the trees, or nestled into a valley surrounded by dark stone bluffs. Farmers and hands dotted the fields, covered in chaff and moving with the slow weariness that comes from knowing half the day's harvest was still to come. We'd only been walking a minute when I heard a familiar thump of hooves behind us. I turned to see a small, open-topped cart bumping slowly up the road. Denna and I stepped off into the scrub as the road was barely wide enough for the cart. A bone-weary farmer eyed us suspiciously from where he sat, hunched over the reins.
"We're heading to the Moffin Farm," Denna called out as he came closer. "Would you mind if we caught a ride?"
The man eyed us grimly, then nodded toward the back of the cart.
"I'm heading past Old Borrill. You'll have to make your own way from there."
Denna and I clambered on and sat facing backward on the clapboard with our feet dangling over the edge. It wasn't much faster than walking, but we were both glad to be off our feet. We rode in silence. Denna obviously wasn't interested in discussing things in front of the farmer, and I was glad to have a moment to think things over. I had planned on telling whatever lies were necessary to get the information I wanted from the witness. Denna complicated things. I didn't want to lie to her, but at the same time I couldn't risk telling her too much. The last thing I wanted to do was convince her that I was crazy with wild stories of the Chandrian. So we rode in silence. It was just nice being near her. You wouldn't think a girl in bandages with a blackened eye could be beautiful, but Denna was. Lovely as the moon. Not flawless, perhaps, but perfect. The farmer spoke up, breaking my reverie.
"Here's Borrill."
I looked around for the rill, but couldn't see it, which was a shame, as I wouldn't mind a cool drink or a bit of a wash. Hours of hard riding had left me sweaty and smelling of horse. We thanked the farmer and hopped off the back of the cart. Denna led the way along the dirt track that wound back and forth up the side of the hill between the trees and the occasional outcrop of worn, dark stone. Denna seemed steadier than when we'd left the tavern, but kept her eyes on the ground, choosing her steps with deliberate care as if she didn't quite trust her balance. A sudden thought came to me. "I got your note," I said, pulling the folded piece of paper out of a pocket in my cloak. "When did you leave it for me?"
"Nearly 2 span ago."
I grimaced. "I only got it last night." She nodded to herself.
"I worried about that when you never showed up. I thought it might have fallen out or gotten wet so you couldn't read it."
"I just haven't used the window lately," I said. Denna shrugged nonchalantly.
"Silly of me to assume you would, really."
I tried to think of something to add. Something that would explain what she might have seen when Fella had given me my cloak in the Aeolian. I couldn't think of anything. "I'm sorry I missed our lunch." Denna looked up, amused. "Diok said you were caught in a fire or something. Told me that you looked positively wretched." "I felt wretched," I said. "More from missing you than from the fire." She rolled her eyes. "I'm sure you were terribly distraught. You did me a favor, in a way. While I was sitting there, alone, pining away, I said I was sorry. An older gentleman introduced himself to me. We talked, got to know each other." She shrugged and looked sideways at me, almost bashfully.
I've been meeting with him ever since. If things continue smoothly, I think he'll be my patron before the year is out.
Really?
I said, relief splashing over me like cold water.
That's wonderful and long overdue. Who is he?
She shook her head, her dark hair falling down around her face. I can't say. He's obsessed with his privacy. He wouldn't tell me his real name for more than a span. Even now, I don't know if the name he's given me is real.
If you're not sure who he really is, I said slowly, how do you know he's a gentleman?
It was a foolish question. We both knew the answer, but she said it anyway. Money, clothes, bearing, she shrugged. Even if he's only a wealthy merchant, he'll still make a good patron.
But not a great one. Merchant families don't have the same stability,
and their names don't carry the same weight, she finished with another knowing shrug. Half a loaf is better than none, and I'm tired of having no loaf at all, she sighed. I've been working hard to reel him in, but he's so dodgy. We never meet in the same place twice, and never in public. Sometimes he'll set up a meeting and never even show up for it. Not that that's anything new in my life.
Denna staggered as a rock shifted under her foot. I grabbed for her, and she caught hold of my arm and shoulder before she fell. For a moment, we were pressed against each other, and I was very aware of her body against mine, as she took a moment to balance herself. I steadied her, and we moved apart. But after she regained her footing, she kept her hand resting lightly on my arm. I moved slowly, as if a wild bird had landed there, and I was desperately trying to avoid startling it into flight. I considered putting my arm around her, partly for support and partly for other more obvious reasons. I quickly discarded the idea. I still remembered the look on her face when she mentioned the constable touching her leg. What would I do if she had a similar response to me? Men flocked around Denna, and I knew from our conversations how tiresome she found them. I couldn't bear the thought of making the same mistakes they made, simply because I didn't know any better. It was better not to risk offending her, better to be safe. As I've said before, there's a great difference between being fearless and being brave. We followed the path as it doubled back on itself, continuing up the hill. All was silent except for the wind moving in the tall grass.
"So he's secretive," I prompted gently, worried that the silence would soon become uncomfortable.
"Secretive doesn't cover it by half," Denna said, rolling her eyes. "Once a woman offered me money for information about him. I played dumb, and later when I told him about it, he said it had been a test to see how much I could be trusted. Another time, some men threatened me. I'm guessing that was another test."
The fellow sounded rather sinister to me, like a fugitive from the law or someone hiding from his family. I was about to say so when I saw Denna looking at me anxiously. She was worried. Worried that I would think less of her for pandering to the whimsy of some paranoid lordling. I thought about my talk with Diok, about the fact that, hard as my lot was, hers was undoubtedly harder. What would I put up with if I could win a powerful noble's patronage? What would I go through to find someone who would give me money for lute strings, see that I was dressed and fed, and protect me from vicious little bastards like Ambrose? I bit back my previous comments and gave her a knowing grin.
"He'd better be rich enough to be worth your trouble," I said. "Bags of money. Pots of it."
Her mouth quirked up at the corner, and I felt her body relax, glad that I wasn't judging her.
"Well, that would be telling now, wouldn't it?" Her eyes danced, saying, "Yes." "He's the reason I'm here," she continued. "He told me to show up at this wedding. It's a lot more rural than I expected, but..."
She shrugged again, a silent comment about the inexplicable desires of the nobility.
"I expected my patron-to-be to be there." She stopped, laughing. "Did that even make any sense?"
"Just make up a name for him," I suggested.
"You pick one," she said. "Don't they teach you about names at the university?"
"Annabelle," I suggested.
"I will not," she said, laughing. "Refer to my potential patron as Annabelle."
"The Duke of Rich Money?" Now you're just being flippant. Try again. Just tell me when I hit one you like. Frederick the Flippant. Frank. Farron. Foru. Fordale. She shook her head at me as we climbed the crest of the hill. As we finally reached the top, the wind gusted past us. Denna gripped my arm for balance, and I held up a hand to shield my eyes from dust and leaves. I coughed in surprise as the wind forced a leaf straight into my mouth, causing me to choke and sputter. Denna thought this was particularly funny. "Fine," I said, as I fished the leaf out of my mouth. It was yellow, shaped like a spearhead. "The wind has decided for us. Master Ash."
"Are you sure it isn't Master Elm?" she asked, eyeing the leaf. "It's a common mistake."
"Tastes like an ash," I said. "Besides, elm is feminine." She nodded seriously, though her eyes were dancing.
"Ash it is, then."
As we made it out of the trees and over the top of the hill, the wind gusted again, pelting us with more debris before it died down. Denna took a step away from me, muttering and rubbing at her eyes. The part of my arm where her hand had rested suddenly felt very cold.
"Black hands," she said, scrubbing at her face. "I've got chaff in my eyes."
"Not chaff," I said, looking across the top of the hill. Not 50 feet away was a cluster of charred buildings that must have once been the Mothin farm.
"Ash."
I led Denna to a little stand of trees that blocked the wind and the sight of the farm. I gave her my water bottle and we sat on a fallen tree, resting as she rinsed her eyes clean.
"You know," I said hesitantly, "you don't need to go over there. I could look for your things if you tell me where you left them."
Her eyes narrowed a little. "I can't tell if you're being considerate or condescending." "I don't know what you saw last night, so I don't know how delicate I should be."
"I don't need much delicacy as a rule," she said shortly. "I'm no blushing daisy."
"Daisies don't blush." Denna looked at me, blinking her red eyes. "You're probably thinking of shrinking violet or blushing virgin. Either way, daisies are white. They can't blush."
"That," she said flatly, "was condescending."
"Well, I thought I'd let you know what it looked like," I said, "for comparison, so there's less confusion when I'm trying to be considerate." We stared at each other for a bit. Eventually, she looked away, rubbing at her eyes.
"Fair enough," she admitted.
She tilted her head back and splashed more water onto her face, blinking furiously. "I really didn't see much," she said as she daubed her face on her shirt sleeve. "I played before the wedding, then again while they were getting ready for supper. I kept expecting my..." She gave a faint smile. "Master Ash to make an appearance, but I knew I couldn't dare ask about him. For all I knew, the whole thing was another test of his." She trailed off, frowning. "He has a way of signaling me, a way of letting me know when he's around. I excused myself and found him over by the barn. We headed into the woods for a bit, and he asked me questions. Who was there, how many people, what they looked like." She looked thoughtful. "Now that I'm thinking of it, I think that was the real test. He wanted to see how observant I was."
"He almost sounds like a spy," I mused.
Denna shrugged. "We wandered for about half an hour, talking. Then he heard something and told me to wait for him. He headed off toward the farmhouse and was gone for a long while."
"How long?"
10 minutes, she shrugged. "You know how it is when you're waiting for someone. It was dark and I was cold and hungry." She wrapped her arms around her stomach and leaned forward a little. "Gods, I'm hungry now, too. I wish I would have..." I pulled an apple out of my travel sack and handed it to her. They were gorgeous, red as blood, sweet and crisp. The sort of apples you dream about all year but can only get for a few weeks during the fall. Denna gave me a curious look. "I used to travel a lot," I explained as I took one for myself, "and I used to be hungry a lot, so I usually carry something to eat. I'll fix you a real dinner when we set camp for the night."
"And he cooks, too."
She bit into the apple and took a drink of water to wash it down. "Anyway, I thought I heard shouting, so I headed back in the direction of the farm. When I came out from behind a bluff,
I could definitely hear screaming and shouting. Then I got closer and smelled smoke, and I saw the light of the fire through the trees.
"What color was it?" I asked, my mouth half full of apple.
Denna looked at me sharply, her expression suddenly suspicious.
"Why do you ask that?"
"I'm sorry, I interrupted," I said, swallowing my mouthful of apple. "Finish your story first, and I'll tell you afterward."
"I've been talking an awful lot," she said, "and you haven't made any mention at all of why you're up in this little corner of the world. The masters down at the university heard some odd rumors and sent me here to find out if they were true," I said. There was no awkwardness or hesitation in the lie. I didn't even plan it, really. It just came out. Forced to make a snap decision, I couldn't safely tell her the truth about my search for the Chandrian. I couldn't bear the thought of Denna thinking I was brain-addled.
"The university does that sort of thing?" Denna asked.
"I thought you lot just sat around reading books."
"Some folks read," I admitted. "But when we hear strange rumors, someone needs to go out and find out what's really happened. When people get superstitious, they start to look toward the university and think, who around here is meddling with dark powers better left alone? Who should we toss into a great blazing bonfire?"
"So you do this sort of thing a lot?" She made a gesture with her half-eaten apple.
"Investigate things?"
I shook my head. "I just got on a master's bad side. He made sure I drew the short straw for this little trip."
Not a bad lie, considering it was off the cuff. It would even hold up if she did any asking around, as parts of it were true. When necessity demands it, I'm an excellent liar. Not the noblest of skills, but useful. It ties closely to acting and storytelling, and I learned all three from my father, who was a master craftsman.
"You are so full of horseshit," she said matter-of-factly. I froze with my teeth halfway into my apple. I pulled back, leaving white impressions in the red skin.
"I beg your pardon?"
She shrugged. "If you don't want to tell me, that's fine, but don't fabricate some story out of a misguided desire to pacify or impress me."
I drew a deep breath, hesitated, and let it out slowly.
"I don't want to lie to you about why I'm here," I said, "but I worry what you might think if I tell you the truth."
Denna's eyes were dark, thoughtful, and gave nothing away.
"Fair enough," she said at last, with an almost imperceptible nod. "I believe that." She took a bite of her apple and gave me a long look as she chewed, never looking away from my eyes. Her lips were wet and redder than the apple.
"I heard some rumors," I said at last, "and I want to know what happened here. That's all, really. I just..."
"Listen, Quoth, I'm sorry."
Denna sighed and ran a hand through her hair. "I shouldn't have pushed you. It's none of my business, really. I know what it's like to have secrets."
I almost told her everything then. The whole story about my parents, the Chandrian, the man with black eyes and a nightmare smile. But I worried it might seem like the desperate elaboration of a child caught in a lie. So instead, I took the coward's way out and stayed silent.
"You'll never find your true love that way," Denna said.
I snapped out of my reverie, confused.
"I'm sorry, what?"
"You eat the core of your apple," she said, amused. "You eat it all around, then from the bottom to the top. I've never seen anyone do that before."
"Old habit," I said dismissively, not wanting to tell her the truth, that there had been a time in my life when the core was all of the apple I was likely to find, and I'd been glad of it.
"What did you mean before? Didn't you ever play that game?"
She held up her own apple core and grabbed the stem with two fingers.
"You think of a letter and twist. If the stem stays on, you think of another letter and twist again. When the stem breaks off," hers did, "you know the first letter of the name of the person you are going to fall in love with."
I looked down at the tiny piece of apple I had left, not enough to grip and twist. I bit off the last of the apple and tossed the stem. "Looks like I'm destined to be loveless."
"There you go with seven words again," she said with a smile. "You do realize you always do that?"
It took me a minute to realize what she was referring to, but before I could respond, Denna had moved on. I heard the seeds are supposed to be bad for you, she said. They have arsenic in them. That's just a wives' tale, I said. It was one of the 10,000 questions I'd asked Ben when he traveled with the troop. It's not arsenic. It's cyanide. And there's not enough to hurt you unless you eat buckets full.
Oh.
Denna gave the remains of her apple a speculative look, then began to eat it from the bottom up. You were telling me about what happened to Master Ash before I rudely interrupted, I prompted gently as I could. Denna shrugged. There isn't much left to tell. I saw the fire, came closer, heard more shouting and commotion. And the fire? She hesitated. Blue. I felt a sort of anticipation rise up in me. Excitement at finally being close to answers about the Chandrian. Fear at the thought of being close to them. What did the ones look like who attacked you? How did you get away? She gave a bitter laugh. Nobody attacked me. I saw shapes outlined against the fire and ran like Billy Hell. She lifted her bandaged arm and touched the side of her head. I must have gone headfirst into a tree and knocked myself out. I woke up in town this morning. That's the other reason I needed to come back, she said. I don't know if Master Ash might still be out here. I didn't hear anyone in town talking about finding an extra body, but I couldn't ask without making everyone suspicious.
And he wouldn't like that, I said.
Denna nodded. I don't doubt he'll turn this into another test to see how well I can keep my mouth shut. She gave me a significant look. Speaking of which, I'll make a point of being terribly surprised if we find anyone, I said. Don't worry. She smiled nervously. Thanks. I just hope he's alive. I've invested 2 whole span trying to win him over. She took a final drink out of my water bottle and handed it back to me. Let's go have a look around, shall we? Denna came unsteadily to her feet, and I tucked my water bottle back into my travel sack, watching her out of the corner of my eye. I had worked in the Medica for the better part of a year. Denna had been struck on her left temple hard enough to blacken her eye and bruise her well past her ear into her hairline. Her right arm was bandaged, and from the way she carried herself, I guessed she had some serious bruises along her left side, if not a few broken ribs. If she had run into a tree, it must have been an oddly shaped tree. But still, I didn't make a point of it. Didn't press her. How could I? I, too, knew what it was like to have secrets. The farm was nowhere near as gruesome as it could have been. The barn was nothing but a jumble of ash and planking. To one side, a water trough stood next to a charred windmill. The wind tried to spin the wheel, but it only had 3 fins left, and it simply swayed back and forth, back and forth. There were no bodies. Only the deep ruts wagon wheels had cut into the turf when they had come to haul them away. How many people were at the wedding? I asked. 26, counting the bride and groom. Denna kicked idly at a charred timber, half buried in ashes near the remains of the barn. Good thing it usually rains in the evenings here, or this whole side of the mountain would be on fire by now. Any simmering feuds lurking around here? I asked. Rival families? Another suitor looking for revenge? Of course, Denna said easily. Little town like this, that's what keeps things on an even keel. These folk will carry a grudge for 50 years about what their Tom said about our Carrie. She shook her head. But nothing of the killing sort. These were normal folk. Normal, but wealthy, I thought to myself as I walked toward the farmhouse. This was the sort of house only a wealthy family could afford to build. The foundation and the lower walls were solid gray stone. The upper story was plaster and timber with stone reinforcing the corners. Still, the walls sagged inward on the verge of collapse. The windows and door gaped with dark soot licking out around the edges. I peered through the doorway and saw the gray stone of the walls charred black. There was broken crockery scattered among the remains of furniture and charred floorboards. If your things were in there, I said to Denna, I think they're as good as gone. I can go in for a look, Don't be stupid, she said. This whole thing is about to come down.
She knocked a knuckle against the doorframe. It echoed hollowly. Curious at the odd sound of it, I went over to look. I picked at the doorpost with a fingernail, and a long splinter the size of my palm peeled away with little resistance.
This is more like driftwood than timber, I said. After spending all this money, why skimp on the doorframe?
Denna shrugged.
Maybe the heat of the fire did it.
I nodded absently and continued to wander around, looking things over. I bent to pick up a piece of charred shingle and muttered a binding under my breath. A brief chill spread up my arms, and flame flickered to life along the rough edge of the wood.
That's something you don't see every day, Denna said.
Her voice was calm, but it was a forced calm, as if she was trying to sound nonchalant. It took me a moment to figure out what she was talking about. Simple sympathy like this was so commonplace in the university that I hadn't even thought about how it would look to someone else.
Just a little meddling with dark forces better left alone, I said lightly, holding up the burning shingle.
The fire was blue last night?
She nodded.
Like a coal gas flame. Like the lamps they have in Annalyn.
The shingle was burning an ordinary, cheerful orange. No trace of blue about it, but it could have been blue last night. I dropped the shingle and crushed it out with my boot. I circled the house again. Something was bothering me, but I couldn't put my finger on it. I wanted to go inside for a look around.
The fire really wasn't that bad, I called out to Denna.
What did you end up leaving inside?
Not that bad, she said incredulously as she came around the corner.
The place is a husk.
I pointed. The roof isn't burned through except right by the chimney. That means the fire probably didn't damage the second story very much. What of yours was in there?
I had some clothes and a lyre Master Ash bought for me.
You play the lyre? I was surprised.
How many strings?
7. I'm just learning.
She gave a brief, humorless laugh. I was learning. I'm good enough for a country wedding, and that's about it.
Don't waste yourself on the lyre, I said. It's an archaic instrument with no room for subtlety.
Not to disparage your choice of instrument, I said quickly. It's just that your voice deserves better accompaniment than a lyre can give you.
If you're looking for a straight-string instrument you can carry with you, go for a half-harp.
You're sweet, she said. But I didn't pick it. Mr. Ash did.
I'll push him for a harp next time. She looked around aimlessly and sighed.
If he's still alive.
I peered in one of the gaping windows to look around, only to have a chunk of the windowsill snap off in my hands when I leaned on it.
This one's rotten through, too, I said, crumbling it in my hands.
Exactly. Denna took hold of my arm and pulled me away from the window. The place is just waiting to fall in on you. It's not worth going in. Like you said, it's just a lyre.
I let myself be led away.
Your patron's body might be up there.
Denna shook her head. He's not the sort to run into a burning building and get himself trapped. She gave me a hard look.
What do you think you're going to find in there, anyway?
I don't know, I admitted. But if I don't go inside, I don't know where else to look for clues about what really happened here.
What rumors did you hear, anyway? Denna asked.
Not much, I admitted, thinking back to what the bargeman had said.
A bunch of people were killed at a wedding. Everyone dead, torn apart like rag dolls. Blue fire.
They weren't really torn apart, Denna said. From what I heard in town, it was a lot of knife and sword work.
I hadn't seen anyone wearing so much as a belt knife since I'd been in town. The closest thing had been farmers with sickles and scythes in the fields. I looked back at the sagging farmhouse, sure that I was missing something.
So what do you think happened here? She asked.
I don't know, I said. I was half expecting to find nothing. You know how rumors get blown out of proportion. I looked around. I would have written the blue fire off to rumor if you hadn't been here to confirm it.
Other people saw it last night, she said. Things were still smoldering when they came for the bodies and found me. I looked around, irritated. I still felt like I was missing something, but I couldn't think of what in the world it could be. "What do they think in town?" I asked. "Folk weren't really talkative around me," she said bitterly. "But I caught a bit of the conversation between the constable and the mayor. Folk are whispering about demons. The blue fire made sure of that. Some folk were talking about shamble men. I expect the harvest festival will be more traditional than usual this year. Lots of fires and cider and straw men." I looked around again. The collapsed wreckage of the barn, a windmill with three fins, and a burned-out husk of a house. Frustrated, I ran my hands through my hair, still sure I was missing something. I'd expected to find something. Anything. As I stood there, it occurred to me how foolish the hope was. What had I hoped to find? A footprint? A scrap of cloth from someone's cloak? Some crumpled note with a vital piece of information conveniently written out for me to find? That sort of thing only happened in stories. I pulled out my water bottle and drank off the last of it. "Well, I'm done here," I said as I walked over to the water trough. "What are you planning to do next?" "I need to look around a bit," she said. "There's a chance my gentleman friend is out there, hurt." I looked out over the rolling hills, gold with autumn leaves and wheat fields, green with pasture and stands of pine and fir. Scattered throughout were the dark scars of bluffs and stone outcroppings. "There's a lot of ground to cover," I said. She nodded, her expression resigned. "I've got to at least make an effort." "Would you like some help?" I asked. "I know a little woodcraft." "I certainly wouldn't mind the company," she said, "especially considering the fact that there may be a troop of marauding demons in these parts. Besides, you already offered to make me dinner tonight." That I did. I made my way past the charred windmill to the iron hand pump. I grabbed the handle, leaned my weight against it, and staggered as it snapped off at the base. I stared at the broken pump handle. It was rusted through to the center, crumbling away in gritty sheets of red rust. In a sudden flash, I remembered coming back to find my troop killed that evening so many years ago. I remembered reaching out a hand to steady myself and finding the strong iron bands on the wagon's wheel rusted away. I remembered the thick, solid wood falling to pieces when I touched it. "Quoth?" Denna's face was close to mine, her expression concerned. "Are you all right? Taylu Blacken, sit down before you fall down. Are you hurt?" I moved to sit on the edge of the water trough, but the thick planking crumbled under my weight like a rotten stump. I let gravity pull me the rest of the way down and sat on the grass. I held the rusted through pump handle up for Denna to see. She frowned at it. "That pump was new. The father was bragging about how much it had cost to get a well set up here at the top of the hill. He kept saying that no daughter of his would have to carry buckets uphill 3 times a day. "What do you think happened here?" I asked, truthfully. She looked around, the bruise on her temple a sharp contrast against her pale skin. "I think when I'm done looking for my patron-to-be, I'm going to wash my hands of this place and never look back." "That's not an answer," I said. "What do you think happened?" She looked at me for a long moment before responding. "Something bad. I've never seen a demon, and I don't ever expect to. But I've never seen the King of Vint, either." "Do you know that children's song?" Denna looked at me blankly, so I sang. "When the hearth fire turns to blue, what to do, what to do? Run outside, run and hide. When your bright sword turns to rust, who to trust, who to trust? Stand alone, standing stone." Denna grew paler as she realized what I was implying. She nodded and chanted the chorus softly to herself. "See a woman pale as snow, silent come and silent go. What's their plan, what's their plan? Chandrian, Chandrian.
Denna and I sat in the patchwork shade of the autumn trees, out of sight of the ruined farm. Chandrian. The Chandrian were really here. I was still trying to collect my thoughts when she spoke.
"Is this what you were expecting to find?" she asked.
"It's what I was looking for," I said.
"The Chandrian were here less than a day ago."
"But I didn't expect this. I mean, when you're a child and you go digging for buried treasure, you don't expect to find any. You go looking for Dennerlings and fairies in the forest, but you don't find them."
"They killed my troop, and they killed this wedding party."
"Hell, I go looking for you and Imre all the time, but I don't actually expect to find you." I trailed off, realizing that I was blathering. Some of the tension bled out of Denna as she laughed. There was no mocking in it, only amusement.
"So, am I lost treasure or a failing?"
"You're both. Hidden, valuable, much sought and seldom found." I looked up at her, my mind hardly attending to what was coming out of my mouth. "There's much of the Fae in you as well."
"They are real. The Chandrian were real."
"You're never where I look for you. Then you appear all unexpected, like a rainbow." Over the last year, I'd held a silent fear in my secret heart. I worried at times that the memory of my troop's death and the Chandrian had just been a strange sort of grief dream my mind had created to help me deal with the loss of my entire world. But now I had something resembling proof. They were real. My memory was real. I wasn't crazy. When I was a child, I chased a rainbow for an hour one evening. It got lost in the woods. My parents were frantic. I thought I could catch up to it. I could see where it should touch the ground. "That's what you're..." Denna touched my arm. I felt the sudden warmth of her hand through my shirt. I drew a deep breath and smelled the smell of her hair, warm with the sun. The smell of green grass and her clean sweat and her breath and apples. The wind sighed through the trees and lifted her hair so that it tickled my face. Only when sudden silence filled the clearing did I realize that I'd been keeping up a steady stream of mindless chatter for several minutes. I flushed with embarrassment and looked around, suddenly remembering where I was.
"You were a little wild around the eyes there," she said gently. "I don't think I've ever seen you out of sorts before."
I took another slow breath. "I'm out of sorts all the time," I said. "I just don't show it."
"My point exactly."
She took a step back, her hand slowly sliding down the length of my arm until it fell away.
"So what now?"
I have no idea. I looked around aimlessly.
"That doesn't sound like you either," she said.
"I'd like a drink of water," I said, then gave a sheepish grin at how childish it sounded. She grinned back at me.
"That's a good place to start," she teased. "After that..."
"I'd like to know why the Chandrian attacked here."
"What's their plan, eh?"
She looked serious.
"There isn't much middle ground with you, is there?
All you want is a drink of water and then the answer to a question that folk have been guessing at since... well, since forever."
"What do you think happened here?" I asked.
"Who do you think killed these folks?" She crossed her arms in front of her chest.
"I don't know," she said. "It could have been all manner of..."
She stopped, chewing on her lower lip.
"No, that's a lie," she said at last. "It sounds strange to say, but I think it was them. It sounds like something out of a story, so I don't want to believe it. But I do."
She looked at me nervously.
"That makes me feel better."
I stood up. I thought I might be a little crazy.
"You still might be," she said. "I'm not a good touchstone to use for judging your sanity."
"Do you feel crazy?" She shook her head, a half smile curling the corner of her mouth.
"No. How about you?"
Not particularly.
That's either good or bad, depending, she said. How do you propose we go about solving the mystery of the ages?
I need to think on it for a while, I said. In the meantime, let's find your mysterious master, Ash. I'd love to ask him a few questions about what he saw back at the Mothin farm. Denna nodded.
I was thinking I would head back to where he left me, behind that bluff, then look between there and the farm, she shrugged. It's not much of a plan.
It gives us a place to start, I said. If he came back and found you were gone, he might have left a trail that we could pick up.
Denna led the way through the woods. It was warmer here. The trees kept the wind at bay, but the sun could still peer through as many of the trees were nearly bare. Only the tall oaks were still holding all their leaves like self-conscious old men. As we walked, I tried to think of what reason the Chandrian could have had for killing these people. Was there any similarity between this wedding party and my troop? Someone's parents have been singing the entirely wrong sort of songs.
What did you sing last night, I asked, for the wedding?
The usual, Denna said, kicking through a pile of leaves. Bright stuff. Penny whistle, come wash in the river, copper bottom pot, she chuckled. Aunt Emmy's tub.
You didn't, I said aghast. At a wedding?
A drunk grandfather asked for it. She shrugged as she made her way through a thick tangle of yellow bannerbier. There were a few raised eyebrows, but not many. They're earthy folk around here. We walked a little longer in silence. The wind gusted in the high branches above us, but where we trudged along, it was just a whisper. I don't think I've ever heard come wash before.
I'd have thought. Denna looked over her shoulder at me. Are you trying to trick me into singing for you?
Of course. She turned and smiled warmly at me, her hair falling into her face. Maybe later. I'll sing for my supper. She led us around a tall outcrop of dark stone. It was chillier here, out of the sun.
I think he left me here, she said, looking around uncertainly. Everything looks different during the day.
Do you want to search the route back toward the farm, or circle out from here?
Circles, she said, but you'll have to show me what I'm supposed to be looking for. I'm a city girl.
I briefly showed her what little I knew of woodcraft. I showed her the sort of ground where a boot will leave a scuff or a print. I pointed out how the pile of leaves she had walked through were obviously disturbed, and how the branches of the bannerbier were broken and torn where she'd struggled through. We stayed close together, as two pairs of eyes are better than one, and neither of us was eager to set off alone. We worked back and forth, making larger and larger arcs away from the bluff. After 5 minutes, I began to sense the futility of it. It was just too much forest. I could tell that Denna quickly came to the same conclusion. The storybook clues we hoped to find once again failed to show themselves. There were no torn scraps of cloth clinging to branches, no deep boot prints or abandoned campsites. We did find mushrooms, acorns, mosquitoes, and raccoon scat cleverly concealed by pine needles.
"Do you hear water?" Denna asked.
I nodded. "I could really do with a drink," I said, "and a bit of a wash." We wandered wordlessly away from our search, neither one of us wanting to admit that we were eager to give up, both of us feeling in our bones how pointless it was. We followed the sound of running water down the hill until we pushed through a thick stand of pine trees and came upon a lovely, deep stream about 20 feet across. There was no scent of foundry runoff in this water, so we drank, and I topped off my water bottle. I knew the shape of stories. When a young couple comes to a river, there is a definite shape to what will happen next. Denna would bathe on the other side of the nearby fir tree, out of sight on a sandy bit of shore. I would move off a discreet distance, out of sight but within easy talking distance. Then, something would happen. She would slip and turn her ankle, or cut her foot on a sharp stone, and I'd be forced to rush over, and then... but this was not a story of two young lovers meeting by the river. So I splashed some water on my face and changed into my clean shirt behind a tree. Denna dipped her head in the water to cool off. Her glistening hair was dark as ink until she wrung it out with her hands. Then we sat on a stone, dandling our feet in the water and enjoying each other's company as we rested. We shared an apple, passing it back and forth between bites, which is close to kissing, if you've never kissed before. And after some gentle goading, Denna sang for me. One verse of Come Wash, a verse I had never heard before, which I suspect she made up on the spot. I will not repeat it here, as she sang it to me, not to you. And since this is not the story of two young lovers meeting by the river, it has no particular place here, and I will keep it to myself.